And you are tuned to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua. My name is Eddie Nix, and this is Conversations. Today we're talking with poet, musician, permaculturist, and all-around weirdo, Mikkel Ande from the hamlet of West Lima. We're going to start this conversation with a short piece of music that he did. Enjoy. Well, we might not. Let's just start talking. Hi, Mikkel.
Hey, Eddie. So much for technology.
Yeah, technology's always a drag. So tell us a little bit about how you came to the Driftless. You are one of the founders of a community called Dreamtime Village out in West Lima. How did that all happen?
My wife Lix and I were living in Madison and Willie Street. We had a project called the Church of Anarchy. If you entered one door, and if you entered a different door, it was called the Avant-Garde Museum of Temporary Art. And around 1990 or so, that block of Willie Street sort of became a crack neighborhood, and we had a little boy, Zahn, and we wanted to get out of there, just a better place. And we started looking in the country. And the next thing we knew, we met a psychedelic entrepreneur who donated a bunch of properties to our nonprofit. Our nonprofit is called Zoxial Endarchy. And that's how we arrived in West Lima. But we had, you know, we had been given the old West Lima school and a bunch of properties.
Well, I'm Mark Zuckerberg, I built a grand machine, a digital arena where the world's unseen. Algorithms summon tailoring your site, feeding you the stories that keep you up at night. These algorithms breed fascists, it's true, shaping an arena where the world's unseen. Algorithms summon tailoring your site, feeding you the stories that keep you up at night.
Okay, and that was the song we were trying to play that finally came on. We'll get back to that later. Sorry about that. So you were given these buildings.
Okay, so we ended up West Lima. We actually were intending to move out to the country just for more of the traditional thing. We were looking for kind of a homestead in the hollow. We wanted to have our barn be an art studio and so forth. But that wasn't the way that history played out. Instead, we ended up with the old West Lima School, 28,000 square foot of amazing, amazing space. And we did a lot of visioning and a lot of talking, and we were in contact with people all over the United States that were in sort of avant-garde art movements and the anarchist movement and other kind in permaculture and so forth. And within a couple months, we decided that we wanted to create a permaculture hypermedia eco-village project called Dreamtime Village. And we chose the word Dreamtime because a couple things from the Dreamtime is a philosophy of the Aborigines of Australia. And a couple things that really attracted our attention with the Aborigine Dreamtime was they don't have words in their languages that separate what they do to get their food and what they do to do their art, their music. It's all an integrated kind of thing. For instance, if they go on a walkabout, they would paint their face. Perhaps they do some dancing and play didgeridoos and different kinds of musical instruments and go out and, you know, hunt kangaroos or something. But they don't have a language that says, well, now I'm doing art, now I'm going to eat. It's all integrated in their language. And we were trying to create a sense of getting away from the sort of the aesthetics of the art world, which really a lot of the art we had done previously was done in art galleries, was done based on getting grants and so forth, and it was all very, very much moderated by sort of the aesthetics of the 19th century. And we wanted to have much more art is life, life is art sort of approach. What was the other? I lost track of the other thing I was going to say about it. But so anyway, we called ourselves Dreamtime Village, and the next thing we knew, all of a sudden, just the whole thing exploded. There was an article in the Village Voice about our project. There was an article in several other national newspapers and magazines, and We went from just being a couple people there to having people visiting from literally all over the country and all over the world, because we had lots of spaces, there was places for people to stay. And we sort of began the process of creating an intentional community that was very, very tolerant, very based on exploring what all the possibilities were, at the same time trying to have our economy in abundance based on our own abilities and our own interests, rather than everybody having to go out and get jobs doing something they didn't want. Over the course of the last 35 years, there's probably been more than 300 people living at Dreamtime, anywhere from a week to, years. And we, while we had the use of the school, we ran it as sort of an alternative, in many ways, just like the folk school, but a little bit more radical and a way more less organized. our projects were, our classes and stuff at the school were geared toward a lot of different kinds of artists and so forth. Also, we Lix did a lot of classes with kids and things in the school. And then when Lix died in 2004, the whole complexion of our community changed. We stopped being sort of having an educational aspect, and we became much more like a co-housing project where primarily people were staying there. And the focus was on a three-acre planting in back of the school, which I call Driftless Sacred Grove. It's a three-acre permaculture forest garden that for many, many years was a demonstration of everything edible and functional and productive that can be produced in the growing season of Southwest Wisconsin.
And I showed up to Dreamtime sometime after you started, around 93, I think, some 30 some years ago.
That's a long time ago.
It is.
You were just a kid then.
I was. And you guys were amazing. It was an amazing place to live. And just be part of this wild community of people from all over. You had a gathering every August, I believe, called the Corrobore, another sort of indigenous Aborigines concept.
A Corrobore is an Aborigine word that means any loud or noisy gathering, which is where that word came from.
What amazed me was there was this mix of, punks from the Lower East Side and rave kids from San Francisco and artists from Europe and just plant people from here. An amazing mix of people that somehow flawlessly came together and enjoyed themselves for that period of time.
The other thing that the Corroborees demonstrated was one of the people who was involved with Dreamtime at the beginning was Peter Lambert Wilson. And he has a book called The Temporary Autonomous Zone. And the Corroborees became really like an illustration of what a temporary autonomous zone could be and look like. And I think Peter was actually at several of them, if I remember correctly, because usually he would be teaching at Naropa in July, and then he would show up at Dreamtime in August when we were having the Corroborees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and over the years, like you said, there were hundreds of people who lived there and participated in the activities and the art and the plants. Right now, you've moved more into, you're an artist and you're a writer and a musician, but you're mostly, I think, a plant guy and a permaculturist. How important is that for you right now? And give me just a brief overview of what permaculture in Southwest Wisconsin looks like.
Well, first, to continue the thread, I for many, many years, since I was probably 14, I've always thought of myself as a poet and writer. I've published about 40 books of poetry. I've done a lot of visual art. I've done a lot of installation art. I've done a huge amount of performance art. And now I'm in the world of plants and botany, fermentation, wine, and it's all exactly the same thing. It's no different than when I was writing poems, 16 years old, sitting all night in a donut shop, eating coffee and donuts, or writing serverless prose poetry. It's exactly the same energy. It's the same goals, the same motives. But now the mediums are genetics, organisms, fermentation, photosynthesis, and it's all just working with elements in a different kind of realm. But the exact, I'm applying the exact same sort of energies to growing that I was to making art and writing.
Do you think most people who engage in the world of plants see themselves as artists, or is that kind of a unique outlook?
There's a huge division, and there's a lot of folks who understand this. Most of them tend not to be teaching horticulture in a university or that kind of thing. There are people who are off grid. There are people who are following their own sort of mentality, as opposed to the kind of the programming that we have about the correct way to grow something, or the correct way to make a wine, or the correct way to design a forest garden. And so, I mean, yes, it's definitely an element out there. But our society wants to suck creativity out of every single action that we do. So it tends to be people who are consciously resisting the impulse to do what you're told and not afraid to experiment.
You also are a prominent member of the Viroqua Farmers Market, have a table there every week and sell your plants and trees. And you don't sell your wine, but tell me how the winemaking evolved.
Well, when Dreamtime began, we got very introduced. Permaculture wasn't really a thing in Wisconsin in the early 90s. I mean, like literally there was no permaculture sort of access to information. And in fact, in 92, when we wanted to really have some help designing our project, we decided to have pretty much the first permaculture intensive gathering in Wisconsin in 1992. That was at Dreamtime. We had 25 teachers there. We had more than 60 students. In these days, the permaculture intensives were much more intense than they are now. They were 17 days long, 14 hours a day. And so we generated an incredible amount of energy. And one of the things in a permaculture design course is everyone generates a design. So in 92, we had the permaculture gathering, and so we ended up with 40 designs of what could happen with the Dreamtime properties in West Lima. And the designs went everywhere from multi-million dollar designs with greenhouses and ponds and all kinds of solarizing the whole school, to designs that were just really, really, dumpster diver kind of designs where, no money was spent and it was just designs based on energy. And so we really spent a lot of time with those and kind of took the best aspects of the design and decided that the 3 acres behind the school would be an example of what kind of biodiversity could be created in, Zone 4B, Wisconsin, Driftless area. And one of the models that we used is that a model of diversity is a hectare of Brazilian rainforest. A hectare is about 2 3/4 acres, about exactly the same size as our planting. A hectare of Brazilian rainforest has about 400 different species of plants. And so that was our model of diversity that we were trying to shoot for. And at the highest point, I would say we had well over 200. But there's a huge difference between Brazil and Wisconsin in the middle of February. So, we're always very, very limited with some of the more exotic possibilities and so forth. But we put a huge amount of stuff in the ground. We got a lot of fruits and nuts and berries going. And by about 95 or 96, we were having way more than we could possibly eat and put up. So I started fermenting and making wines and stuff of pretty much everything that we were growing. And that's really where it came from. In the first couple of years, I had no training in winemaking, no training in anything, really. I quit college 8 times. And the first couple of years, the winemaking was an experiment of making shoe polish. A lot of it was undrinkable. It was thrown away. It wasn't even good for vinegars. And I learned in the planting world and in the winemaking world, I learned mostly by my mistakes, not being afraid to try things. If it worked, I kept experimenting further. If it didn't work, I just went on to something else, because there's so many possibilities that you can do in the world of winemaking.
Give us an example of some of these wines, because they're not conventional Cabernets.
Yeah, none of the wines are traditional. Well, some of the wines that are actually some of the wines and meads that are most popular is I grow a plant called Aronia. Aronia is a native in upper Midwest. It is a 6 to 8 foot high bush that has berries that look like blueberries, and they are super, super astringent. They don't taste like a blueberry, and they're not really refreshing. I eat them fresh, but most people would be spitting them out right away. But when you juice Aronia and start fermenting with it, all of a sudden the mouthfeel, the taste, the resonance of it changes drastically. And especially with a thing like Aronia, Aronia is by many is considered a superfood. Nutritionally, it makes blueberries look like junk food. And so you start making an Aronia mead, and not only do you have a fermented beverage that's drinkable, but you also have a kind of medicine, a kind of energy booster. It has full of antioxidants. And one of the best things about something like Aronia is that it's so full of anthocyanins, the dark color, that you could age an Aronia wine for 100 years and it would be just better and better and better. Other kinds of wines I make are red currant wine, black currant wine. I make a black currant mead. I make different kinds of rhubarb wine. I make apricot peach wine, peach mead. I've been making some pawpaw wines. What else? And lately, I've been actually experimenting with other. I want to get into making tropical wines. So of course, I can't buy the or I can't grow those. So I've been making. I made a guava wine. I made a mango wine, which turned out just incredible. Really, just trying to try a lot of different things.
Hmm. Well, we're going to take a tiny break here at 20 minutes after the hour. Let's play this song. Tell me about this song. It's called These Algorithms Breed Fascists.
The song will speak for itself.
All right. This is Conversations. We're speaking with Mikkel and here this morning. We'll take a small break.
From the moment you wake up, your day is already pretty full. That's why University of Phoenix's online master's programs help you balance work, family, and school. Explore flexible master's degrees made for busy adults at University of Phoenix.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards.
All right, we were trying to play something off SoundCloud and it decided to play some advertisements. So that was a mistake. Let's just get back into it. You're at the farmer's market every week. You have plants and trees. Tell me about some of those. What have been the best sellers? What are the most enjoyable to grow? And how does it feel to have part of Viroqua and the surrounding area planted with your work?
Actually, I was going to start by saying that one of the pleasures in the middle of summer is just to drive around Viroqua, and I can... A lot of the plants I sell, not too many other people are selling, so I can drive around and I can spot this stuff in people's yards and things. I once did a calculation of how many different things I've sold. I've been at the farmer's market since 2013, so I guess this is my 12th year. I'm a member of the vendor advisory board and have been for a long time and really tried to put a lot of energy into cultivating the market as sort of a center of botanical and produce culture. And one of the things one of my focuses at the market is a lot of the people at the market are getting older, and we really need to have younger folks sort of stepping up and figuring out ways to make a living, at least or a partial living, you know, supplying the market with produce and different kinds of things. The times have made it a lot more difficult for people to kind of make their living doing things like farmers market without just putting a tremendous amount of energy, and also just what it takes to actually, you know, produce. You know, one of the reasons I focus on perennial agriculture is that a lot of the energy in annual agriculture is not required. You get the things planted and in the ground, and if you're planting disease-resistant hardy varieties, there's a lot of sort of taking care of plants that you don't have to do if you're growing annual plants. They take care of themselves largely, although, I mean, there's always things that make it more difficult. And then you focus more on harvesting and then how to use the things that you're harvesting. So to circle back, I once made a count of all the different species that I've sold at the market, and it was well over 200 different things over the course of years. So a lot of times I'll just bring something in for one day and it'll sell out right away. And I try a lot of different things. But I also have some that are kind of, I've just really focused on getting pawpaw patches everywhere in the Driftless. So I almost always have pawpaw trees for sale. I have a breeding project where I'm trying to breed a true Zone 4 hardy peach. It's called Siberian C. The peach genetics are from Siberia. The trees themselves are hardy to 45 below zero. You know, the fruit buds aren't that hardy. But in a year of a polar vortex, you'll have a peach tree that doesn't freeze to the ground. And so I bring those to the market. I bring a lot of sort of native stuff like service berries, different kinds of oak trees, something called false indigo, which is a nitrogen fixer. I saw a lot of Nanking cherries, which is a bush cherry that is, it's just meant for sitting next to it and popping the cherries in your mouth and spitting them out. They're not like a cherry pie cherry. The main thing about my project is that for 20 years, I was propagating and making plants, and I gave it all away while I was working. Previous to the market, I was working in Organic Valley, and so I didn't focus at all on selling stuff. But then when I left Organic Valley and needed a job, I just decided to go for it. And so I actually make all my living from the market in the summer, and then in the colder months, I sell nursery stock online, cuttings and stuff of different kinds of permaculture plants, as well as figs, which is one of my big passions. Is I grow 95 varieties of figs. I'm doing a trial to see which varieties of figs will survive the best in this climate.
And you take those figs every year. They're in pots, right?
Yeah, most of my fig trees are in pots. They have to go into a root cellar in West Lima in the winter, and then my greenhouse and my vineyard is like halfway between Lafarge and Viroqua, about 12 miles from where I live. So it's a portable orchard. All those 100-plus trees get moved from West Lima to Webster Township twice a year, once there, once back. It's a grueling sort of migration, but it also, it really tests my resolve to actually do these kind of projects.
Hmm. And what are the most successful sort of after 30-some years of planting this stuff and seeing it grow? And what would you say your most successful sort of variety or plant or species is in that realm of fruit and feeding?
I would say the peaches probably, because they really they want to grow. They're super, super vigorous. A pit germinated in 3 or 4 years will actually be a full-size tree bearing fruit. So it's a thing that is really needed in our area. A lot of people are dependent on getting their peaches from down south and stuff, and so, why not grow these things?
Well, moving on from plants to publishing, you just put out a book. This is like probably your 40th book or something.
Right.
And it's called The Autobiography of Ampersand X. And for those of you who don't know, the word ampersand stands for the and symbol, which is kind of a take on your name, I suppose.
Exactly.
And it's a beautiful book. It's half art, half poetry. And tell me about it.
Well, it just came out a couple weeks ago, and if anybody is interested, I will have copies at my table, and also Eddie will have copies at his bookstore, probably the bookstore downtown, right?
Yeah, both of them, probably.
Both of them. I've made a lot of art about the ampersand. It's just like this curious character that exists in the English language that never, it just gets taken for granted. And so I wanted to animate the ampersand and give it life. There's a famous book that was written in 1880 called Flatland, and it is a book by his last name is Abbott. I don't remember his first name. And in Flatland, it was a two-dimensional world where things are animated and come to life. So it's very much in the – and there's also a book called Sphereland with, written in the 1920s, which was a three-dimensional world, which was animated and come to life. And so I – in that sort of spirit of animating inanimate things, I wanted to have a chance for the ampersand to speak out about the way it's been treated in the English language over the last 300-400 years. And so the book, each page has sort of an abstract version of the ampersand and then a little one-sentence phrase of what that ampersand is thinking at that moment. And it won't do really well for reading online right now because you can't see the images and stuff. But it basically was a way to sort of bring the ampersand alive.
Mm. Well, it's a beautiful book. Beautiful, beautifully done. You're also a poet. It seems like that's one of your main sort of things from the time I've known you. Not a traditional poet by any means, but...
Well, there's an ancient tradition of experimental poets, so...
So you're
it's
OG.
Just a different kind of tradition than what you're talking about.
What is it about poetry that you think attracts you so much to it, rather than prose, let's say, or some other type of writing?
Well, it's my belief that reality is a language construct, and the language that we choose creates our reality. And for the majority of people on this planet, the language they are using is not their language, but it's the language they've been programmed with in school, in media, in the people in their environment. And it's, people are very impressionable, and obviously we're seeing sort of the most perverse sort of realization of that in the current politics and stuff, where people are parroting these things that if they really examined it, they wouldn't actually be saying these things. But instead, they have something else is speaking through them. And so what I've always been interested in is really kind of redoing language from the ground up. And what that means is I spent a lot of time inventing words, inventing words for things that have not existed yet, but perhaps in the future there will be a kind of existence of them. Just yesterday I had a conversation with somebody who was excited because they started describing their compost operation as simplexity and the world of compost making. And I had to explain to him that in the early 80s, when we first started as a publisher, Lix came up with the phrase to describe what we were doing with publishing and books and writing as experimedia simplexity. So it's a word that she's been was using in the early 80s, and then all of a sudden online in 2025, I see this guy describing his compost operation as a form of simplexity. And that's exactly proving to the point that working with language and inventing new language opens up new possibilities and creates new futures. And so that's always been something that I've been really, really interested in. And not only just creating language, but also I do a lot with breaking down syntax and reorganizing syntax in different ways, taking grammar. For instance, when I first started out as a poet, I published my first book when I was about 17, and I probably was publishing poems starting at about the age of 13. And what was I going to say? There were just a lot of different ways that I would. Well, oh, I remember what I was going to say. When I first started publishing poetry, I decided I don't want any capital letters. So I wrote all my poems with no capitalization, no periods, no punctuation, and no apostrophes for contractions. And And, you know, this was in the mid-70s and stuff. And I actually wasn't the only person doing it. There were a lot of poets that were doing this kind of thing, including a very, very famous radical poet named D.A. Levy. And it was just an expression of resistance to all the different ways that sort of, traditional sort of teaching about language programs us to think in one way.
Mm. Do you want to?
Yeah, let's. I have a piece I want to read. I probably won't read all of it. This is a work called Manifesto of the Moment. It was written the first month after Mr. Trump was elected in 2016. Manifesto of the Moment. If you walked by a book on the shelf and it blinked at you, would you want to buy it? Monkeys would do that for half the price. Rehearsing for the imagined moments that might never come. If you're not growing some of your own food, you failed as a poet. Books with shoes that walk until they find someone new to read them. Instead of a constitution, a country founded on nursery rhymes. Do not ignore the man in the brown paper wrapper. This is a cute picture with a witty saying that you will want to share with all your friends. That possibility has yet to be invented. Sometimes I wish the moon was further away. Gentle reader? Yeah, right. A virtual grab bag of useless consonants. I turned the wrong way and I arrived at my destination. There are bodies, but they haven't been told what to do. I feel like a half-naked duck smoking a cigar in a sauna waiting for some eggs to hatch. In a perfect universe exists. The anarchist squirrel chaser greatly improved the psychogeography of the underlying habitat. Don't be embarrassed by the tendency to confuse novelty with innovation. Give me a machete and a book of poems and I'll give you a haiku. The poems evaporate and perspire like an old fat surrealist. Fire sale on antiquated beliefs. Everything must go. There's a flower on the tip of your tongue. Just signed a lifetime contract to be an occasional poet for no pay and no posterity. This text is hampered by your attempts to understand it. Your vibrator poetics just ran out of batteries. The populace is at ads and the wind is blowing hard. Raucous indifference should not be confused with enthusiasm. The angels of hypocrisy are dancing on the head of a pin. Go ahead and try to make art out of that. Apologies to the author. The new poetry is just around the corner. If only memes would disappear as quickly as they appeared. How was I supposed to know what NSFW meant? Interrogating the interrogator liberates the assumptions framing the interrogation. Poetry is just poetry. The source of all knowledge isn't. Poetry has been blackmailing me for years and I can't take it anymore. This word I have in my head is splintered into many indecipherable fragments, a neuro-palimpsest of the yet to be. If the world is a cake, you are the frosting. I wish the future would hurry up and get here. The air of intrigue is scented with the slippery passion of the ineffable. The moon is a communist. Reality? Really? Utopia is just a time machine away. When you start to hear ethereal, alcohol-infused voices, it's a sure sign that it's time to break the typewriter out. That's not what this poem means, but you could think that anyway. Eager to please, the verb became a noun. The library is not complete without you. I'm sorry, I can't be your subtext forever. He brought the house down with his inability to express even the most simple of astonishments. Godot is my co-pilot. The figure of the lone poet on the top of the big hill yodeling to the sunrise. My time machine just got stuck in the snow. Clumsily, I dropped the word on the floor and it shattered into a million little pieces. In my dream last night, I was drinking cat wine. No other details are forthcoming. The probability you will understand versus the likelihood the message decays into forgetfulness. Imagine pulling a book of poetry off the shelf and reading it. If poetry books had more pictures, people would be more likely to open them up. This statement has been stripped of all poetic and artistic intent. It's become clear to me that I was an organ grinder in my last life. Your suitcase is inside out. I apologize if you feel like I've been ignoring you, but the end of history has me in a tizzy. The words for things are not the same as the word for not things. Do dogs think to themselves, it's a human's life? In the interest of science, I will never be a scientist. Yesterday is a dusty piece of luggage with a broken lock. The sudden accumulation of discrete phenomena multiplying beyond expected outcomes. This text zooms to infinite resolution when tickled with fancy. If everyone I know is a poet, who will fix my toilet? Who will fix my toilet when it breaks? Never again will I spend 35 years writing a long poem. Robust captions compensate for lackluster content. Never mind the messiness, it's the divine breath lurking in the nooks and crannies that is source to die for. The tear in the fabric of the space-time continuum is a syntax malfunction. The poetics of the afterlife are all too quiet.
Wow. That was poetry, I must say. It's so refreshing. One of the words that popped out here was psychogeography, one of my favorite concepts. I won't try to describe it, but maybe you can, and what that means in your life as an artist.
It really, for most of my life, one of the things that has verified that the place that I am and what I'm doing is on point is the synchronicities that happen at the same time, and that's because moments are embedded with dimensions that are beyond our comprehension, and we being four-dimensional beings, we don't have the apparatus necessary to comprehend this stuff, so we use things like synchronicity as cues or clues to tell us that, this is right. This is where we're supposed to be at this moment. And so in the realm of psychogeography, it's a way of participating in this kind of drift through life.
Mm. Well, we're going to take our second break and once again attempt to play one of Mikkel's musical pieces. Once again, this is These Algorithms Breed Fascists, and we'll see if we can do it without the egregious advertisements. This is Conversations on WDRT.
Well, I'm Mark Zuckerberg, I built a grand machine, a digital arena where the world's on scene. Algorithms hum and tailor in your sight, feeding you the stories that keep you up at night. These algorithms breed fascists, it's true, shaping the arena where the world's unseen. Algorithms hum and tailor in your sight, feeding you the stories that keep you up at night. These algorithms breed fascists, it's true, shaking minds and hearts with every view. Censorship's a tool in the rich man's hand, keeping all the power across this land. We filter information, decide what you can see, guiding your emotions intentionally. Echo chambers growing, voices sound the same, while billionaires are profiting from this very game. These algorithms breed fascists, it's true, amplifying fears as they accrue. Censorship helps us as part of the plan to keep the wealth flowing to the top of the clan. Control the conversation, silence dissent, monopolize attention, that's how it's meant. Divide and conquer, keep the masses blind, as long as profits soar, we pay no mind. These algorithms breed fascists, it's true, manipulating thoughts of me and you. Censorship's the key to the billionaire's delight, while shadows grow longer in the fading light. But somewhere in the code, a change can be made to break the chains of bias that we've laid. If we hand back the power to every woman and man, we might just find redemption in this land. These algorithms breed fascists, it's true, but now we're taking back the narrative anew. Censorship no more for the billionaire's gain, let freedom ring across the digital plane. Breed fascists, it's true, but now we're taking back the narrative ever new. Censorship no more for the billionaire's gain, let freedom ring across the digital plane.
And we are tuned to Conversations here on WDRT. That was a piece of music entitled These Algorithms Breed Fascists by Hieronymus Steamcake, a.k.a. Mikkel And. You obviously didn't sing that and play the music on it. How is it an AI thing or what?
It's an AI-generated thing, yes.
Okay, so you've been pretty entranced with AI since it came about. How do you see it as an artist? I mean, my buddy Brett Newsky has stickers that say AI art is for quitters, you know.
I'm aware of all the criticisms, believe me. I've been using AI for about, I don't know, 5 years or something. And in the realm of art, about 99.9% of the AI-generated stuff is just crap. AI in itself is a tool. And one of the things that I like to remind people is that when Photoshop came out, and all of a sudden the world was just gutted with horrible, horrible Photoshop art. I still see it 35 years later. And then before that, when copiers came out, before that, when sampling happened, all of a sudden the world was gutted with all kinds of horrible music, you know, using samplers and stuff. So it isn't the technology. I mean, there's valid criticisms of AI. I'm not interested in the AI that the government is using to surveil us, the AI that financial systems now are using for credit card transactions or anytime you're online, the AI that social media is using to track you. These kinds of AI are the things that we should be criticizing and attacking and finding alternatives to. I've been doing art with neural networks, which is what AI is. I've been doing art with neural networks since probably 85 or 86, but using it in a much different way, but creating different kinds of databases and stuff and using neural networks as a way of processing. So it's not, you know, the current manifestation of AI is not all that different than what I've been doing for a long time. As I said earlier, I believe reality is a language construct. And so the thing that I am most interested in with AI is creating alternative timelines that could be as interesting. And a couple of things that, for instance, I've been using AI to create a Venusian culture, Venusian languages, Venusian historical artifacts and so forth. Well, obviously none of that exists, but I can program AI with my own work, and I've loaded a lot of own work into an AI model that I have, and I can query that AI model with stuff to generate based on things that I've done myself. And so it's a little bit different than somebody saying, make a picture of a dinosaur smoking a cigar or something like that, which then will probably use Disney images or something to generate it. It's a really, really different form of AI. And then in the realm of audio AI, I've been using my own samples that I generate, and then you can use AI to do studio kinds of things, which I would do in the past. I would just do it with an app, but I use AI to do it now because it gives me a little bit more flexibility. I've also been working on a book about sacred groves, and one of the things that AI does really well is it has a thing called deep research, where it can really dig into all the databases. A lot of the databases are not accessible without, you know, having paid memberships and stuff. And you could do searches and stuff. So, for instance, I have collected about 1,000 PDFs about Sacred Grove. I loaded all those PDFs into AI, and then I can query AI any questions I have about those PDFs. I mean, the PDFs are probably 10,000 pages of data. There was no way I'm going to read all that data. And so then I can use AI to parse different kinds of questions that I have. Now, those are just three of many, many different ways that I use it.
Mm. In the beginning, when Dreamtime was formed, you had one of the concepts of it along with permaculture, this word hypermedia, which
exactly.
Back in the day had a different meaning, I'm sure.
But it was equally as radical. In 1990, 93 or so, desktop computers were just starting to, the internet was the little baby, and the computers were just starting to become affordable. And the amount of pushback that I got back then was really not all that different than the amount of pushback I get now for using AI. It's just a lot of people were resisting computers. Now all that kind of computing is just integrated into life, and it's invisible. Most people don't think about it. Most of their life is a digital lifestyle, whether they like it or not. You know, if they're doing anything that involves a credit card, anything that involves online, et cetera, you know, even the Amish to some extent, interact with AI because they're using cell phones.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of technology, one of the other hats you wear in the community is one of the administrators of of the Facebook group called Viroqua Area Folks. What is it, 2.0 now? Yeah. Tell me about that. Like what?
It's just Viroqua Area Folks. I think the 2.0 one is somebody else's group.
Oh.
The main one is just Viroqua Area Folks.
Okay.
It's been an incredible, incredible experiment. I believe Sarah Bratnober began the group, and Aaron Ford began the group in 2018, I think. And we've grown to about 25,000 people, and it has become just an incredible, incredible resource for people to make things happen. You know, one of the common things is somebody will post to it saying, I'm moving to the area. I'm looking for this, this, and this, and this, and I want to meet some people and stuff. And I've seen some of these people post, and I've seen in 24 hours, I've seen 200 responses to it. And then these folks get set up. They get the connections made almost spontaneously and easily. And it really has facilitated a lot of kind of networking and connections that would not be possible otherwise. We've also have, one of our focuses is on supporting small businesses and just sort of operations that are just people trying to sell things and stuff. And we really encourage that kind of thing. A lot, for instance, I post once a week what I'm bringing to the farmer's market. And it probably accounts for 30% of my sales every week just because people read my posts and somebody says, oh, hey, that's the thing I want, and they come and get it. It just makes, communication is one of the bottlenecks out here because a lot of folks don't live in Viroqua. They live down the end of some dead end road someplace. And if they aren't out and around, they just don't know about things going on. So our group, the Facebook group has really made a lot of things happen. A couple things, you know, over the years, Facebook decided that pets are really off track. And so the group actually twice in a row had someone post a kitten to sell. And without warning us, Facebook completely deleted the group. The first time was in 2020. There was 16,000 people on it. Somebody posted, "I have my kitty for sale." And without warning, instantaneously, the group was completely deleted. Nothing was saved. And we had to start from zero and had to add people on. We learned our lesson, and then about a year later, the exact same thing happened again. The group was completely deleted, which is now we've become sort of fascist about people selling their kitties on our group because for some reason, Meta Facebook has decided that this is, the world is going to end if somebody sells their kitty. The one other aspect that has happened a lot is for the longest time, it was just two of us admins, and now since the politics in the air have changed a lot, we've added a couple more admins just to burden or just to lighten the load and stuff. And we are spending a huge amount of time, trying to keep the conversation positive, trying to keep people from disrespecting other people. It really, there's just a vibe where people want to hide behind their online identity, and then they'll say things they would never say to you in person. And we just don't want that kind of stuff to happen in our space.
Yeah, it is an amazing resource, but it's also must be extremely challenging to be the gatekeeper for that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to have the other four admins right now. The winter was pretty brutal in terms of the amount. I was spending 4 hours a week, four to 6 hours a week, just adminning and deleting things and stuff like that. And I'm in the middle of the growing season. I would rather be tending my plants than dealing with somebody's anger.
Well, this has been an awesome conversation. Anything else you want to make sure we discuss here and talk about? Big concepts? We did neologisms. We did psychogeography.
One of the other things I've been getting into lately is I've been making vinegars. And just yesterday, I made my my drunken hot sauce, which I should be starting to sell at the farmer's market in the next few weeks. I'm not sure. It's supposed to rain on Saturday. I'm not sure I will be at the market this Saturday. We'll have to see what the weather does. When it's raining and stuff, it's pretty difficult for me to have my stuff set up because all my labels and stuff are water soluble. So even if it doesn't get wet directly, all the labels start melting, and then pretty soon you have these psychedelic labels for the things you're trying to sell. So I may or may not be there on Saturday.
Okay. Getting back to final question, maybe, Dreamtime Village. You also have a publishing company that you had for a long time, way before.
40 years.
Yeah, and it's called Zexoxial Endarchy.
Or Zexoxial Endarchy. There's actually many pronunciations. It's Xexoxial. We were originally called Xerox Sutra, but Xerox Corporation sent us a letter from their trademark division threatening to sue us for competing business interests. This was in like 1982. So then we created a word that looked like Xerox but wasn't Xerox.
And they didn't mess with you?
Then they didn't mess with us, yes.
How many books has that group published?
We published about 200 different titles, and then we also have a magazine called Xerolage, which originally meant Xerox Collage, but it's a visual poetry magazine, and that's up to issue number 72.
And it all started with kind of photocopies, right? I mean, using
that
technology.
It all began with having access to photocopiers in the late 70s and stuff. And I actually ran a press before that, also based on having photocopiers. And then for most of the time that we were living in Madison, we actually bought a photocopier and had it in our house. And we made all the books ourselves. We did all the binding. For hardcover books, we would go to the thrift store. We'd buy old books, tear the guts out, repaint the covers, and then put our books inside for hardcovers. Tremendous amount of handbook making stuff. Since Lix has died, I'm not a bookmaker, so I've been using print-on-demand for printing titles since then because I don't want to spend my time collating and stapling and folding books.
And one of the sort of concepts of that whole art scene that you were involved in was concrete poetry. Can you just give us a brief sort of what that means?
Well, there's different words for it.
It's
In the 1940s, it was called Lettrism. In the 50s and 60s, it was called concrete poetry. In the 70s, it was called visual poetry. In the 80s and 90s, it was called Vizpo. And now people are calling it aesthetics. It all is basically words referring to the same thing. And that's that's using creating, quote, poetic content without necessarily using words as such. And so it's images, collage. I do a lot with inventing characters and inventing languages, mixing together ancient undeciphered languages and using their symbologies and creating new symbologies. I did the Mi'kmaq. Mi'kmaqs of northern Canada had sort of like a visual poetry language created for their language in the 1880s, and a typographer created. I've created a bunch of poems using that invented typography, all kinds of different things.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to talk to you. I wish we had another hour, but hey, that's what we get. Been talking to Mikel And, poet, musician, permaculturist, and community designer, I guess. Thanks so much for being here. We're going to go out with one more of your tunes called In a World Home of Ever Purisings.
Hopefully no ads come on when he plays this.
Can you tell me about this tune?
This is a text I wrote that, once again, I did a bunch of writing in sort of a James Joycean style. So this is a text I created with using Joycean neologisms and then using AI to animate it as a song.
All right. Well, thanks for being here today. This is Conversations, WDRT. Stay tuned.
In a world tummy of ever usings, F-curves mumble is pendulates. Here every being scribbled deduces, lit a cratering experiment metaphors, one worders. Twist sigmas and shrouded binds, logic and grammar in sundered flutter by dodeca dancing alphabets astray. All quotidian constraints unbridled. Quotidian constraints unbridled, though quotient strung, bird on bread along. Layers and litter jumbling togetherness, syntactical jitterbugger repressed at EGS. Mental mirrors, Babylonic escapades of literary flipper to gibbets, ring a docious red, some extroverse, abstruse mazes of narrative.